Good morning. Good morning. I had a lapel mic. Where'd it go? I don't know. I'll use this one. I thought I left it up here. Well, it's Mr. Franklin's fault. He keeps robbing me of this hour of sleep every time this year, so I'll blame him for anything that goes wrong today. I'm glad you are here because I woke up and the gloomy weather outside and then the forecast for snow and then the loss of an hour of sleep, I thought, I just don't know how many are going to come out. But you surprised me, and thank you for being here, and it is a great day to worship. That is any day that we have. As far as tonight goes, they are expecting snow to accumulate here starting about noon, a little after or so. So our evening services may be canceled. Just if you're not sure, call before you come just to make sure that we are having them. So we don't know at this point. If we get as much snow as the weathermen are calling for, they'll probably be canceled. But they've been wrong before, so we'll see. I want to continue on with what I started 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, we talked about the apostles, how Jesus had these 12 close companions, these 12 close friends, but there was more than that. He didn't just want friends. He didn't just want even co-workers. He wanted someone who he could entrust with the job of reaching souls after he had gone. He gave them the job to be sent out. That's what the word apostle means. So they were sent out. And he also gave them the job of having the authority to cast out demons, to perform miracles, so that they could proclaim this message and have the authority, have the backing that the message needed. Now, we don't have that authority in and of ourselves today. I do not have the power within me to cast out demons at will or have the ability to perform miracles at will. I believe God can still perform whatever miracles he so chooses. Our God is a God of miracles, and miracles can still happen in this day and age, but he has not given me the ability to possess them because I don't need them. I don't need the miracles to prove authority because I can now hold the authority in my hands. I have the authority that the apostles left behind for us. So this authority, the New Testament that they gave us, is sufficient for us to continue on with their work. They were sent out with authority. Their authority's gone. We're still sent out. We have their authority passed on to us in Scripture to do the same job they did, to be sent out with the message of the gospel, to be sent out with the message of the kingdom. And so the apostles weren't just close to Jesus, weren't friends of Jesus. They were the ones whom he gave this all-important job. And so I want to look over the next few weeks at some of them specifically. Look at specific groups of the apostles. There's 12 of them. So I thought I'd do four sermons and three apiece, and we'll see how I can line them up and match them up. But I want to look specifically at who they were and what they did and why they were suited for the job, and how we can learn from their character, learn from what they did, so that we can see the job that they were assigned to do and know how we're to do it as well. And so this week, this morning, I want to look at three of them. I want to look at Matthew. Matthew was a pretty famous apostle. Not that we know that much about him. We really know very little about him other than that he was a tax collector sitting at his booth whenever Jesus called him. And then he took him home. Jesus went to Matthew's house for a feast after Jesus called him. But other than that, not a whole lot, of course, except for the fact that he wrote the Gospel of Matthew. So he leaves behind for us this great treasure, this Old Testament or this New Testament account that's often couched in Old Testament terms. He writes from the perspective of an Old Testament Jew, maybe more so than Mark or Luke or John does. But we don't know a whole lot about him, but we get maybe a feel for him. If you read through the Gospel of Matthew, you kind of maybe feel like you get to know him a little bit. Maybe even though we don't know any facts about his life, we feel familiar with him because we read his account, because we read of his account of Jesus. And then also, we're going to look at Thomas, what we just read about, what Brooke just read for us. Thomas, the apostle known famously for being a doubter. I think that's an unfair name for him to bear for all these centuries and millennia since. I think he doesn't get his fair credit. We'll talk about that in a minute as well. But he also interacts with Jesus. He asks Jesus a question in the Gospel of John, saying, Lord, How do we know, how can we follow you if we don't know the way which you're going? And that prompted Jesus to say his famous line, I am the way, the truth, and the life. It was Thomas who asked the question that prompted that response. And Thomas is also the one, whenever they're telling Jesus, don't go back to Judea. Lazarus is sick. Lazarus in Bethany is very close to Jerusalem. They said, Lord, last time we were there, they tried to kill you. Jesus says, it's time to go anyway. Well, it's Thomas who speaks up and says, we'll go with you, and if we die, we die. He says, we'll die with you. And now he tells the others, let's go with them so that we can die too. He's fully expecting for Jesus to be killed, and he's willing to go step by step along with them. So Thomas is really has some really good aspects, I think, to draw from. And then we're also going to look at someone we know hardly anything about, and that is Simon the Zealot. Simon the Zealot is listed in the list of apostles in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And then again in Acts. But other than that, he's not mentioned again. We don't know anything as far as the New Testament goes about what he did, what he said, anything about his life other than the fact of this little term beside his name, Simon the Zealot. And so that's all we have to go off of, but even that little snippet, Simon the Zealot, can teach us about what it means to follow Christ and what it means to proclaim his message, what it means to be his disciple. And so, a zealot. A person who's zealous is someone who's a little bit crazy. Someone who's crazy enough to go after their goal regardless of what stands in the way. Someone who's not going to give up. Someone crazy enough like Ann Marks, who can put up with Frank for so many years. That's someone zealous, someone who's committed. That's what a zealous person is. And so some people think it should be translated, well, Simon the zealous person, Simon the zealous man, Simon the one who was zealous. But the traditional interpretation is Simon the Zealot. And there's a reason for that. There's a historian, I hope I don't bore you this morning, but I think it's interesting. I find it pretty exciting. So just stay with me. But there's a person named Josephus who wrote a history of the Jewish people. And in this history, he's writing from the late first century. So he writes about the same time that Jesus was on the earth. And a lot of what we know about the Jewish people during the first century comes from this guy named Josephus. And Josephus wrote about the sects of the Jews, the different religious branches, the different groups that you could be a part of. In this time frame, in this first century, you had the Sadducees, which are mentioned in the Bible, in the New Testament. You had the Pharisees, which are mentioned in the New Testament. And then he mentions another group called the Essenes. Now, they're not mentioned in the New Testament by name, but they were the ones who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were the ones who lived in the caves. They're the ones who separated themselves away from Jerusalem and lived all by themselves in these closed communities, awaiting for the return of the Messiah. They were the radicals in some ways, or at least they kept themselves separate from everyone else. And some people think that John the Baptist maybe came from a little bit of an Essene background. Some of the things he says and some of the, like the clothes he wears and the fact that he stays out in the desert, some historians think John the Baptist maybe had at least some kind of Essene influence. Whether or not he was an Essene himself, that's a different matter. But those are the three main groups that Josephus talks about within the Jewish religious parties. But then he throws out another term, the zealots. And he talks about the zealots, and he records quite a bit of what the zealots had done. And he says that they started with a man named Judas of Galilee. Now again, it's been a solid month since our Bible Bowl. Anybody remember the term Judas of Galilee? Oh, come on. Acts chapter 5. When Gamaliel is telling his fellow Jews, saying, don't overreact to these guys calling themselves Christians following Christ. He said, remember Judas of Galilee? He rose up in the days of the census. That was about the same time of Jesus' birth. That's why Mary and Joseph traveled to Bethlehem, because of the census. So Judas of Galilee rose up with men with him in the time of the census, but he was put down. The Roman government killed him along with many of his followers, said, and he came to nothing. Well, he came to nothing, but that was kind of the beginning point of what people would say, what Josephus thinks, where the zealots came from. The zealots were those who wanted to fight for Jewish independence. There's a difference between the Pharisees and the zealots. The Pharisees wanted Jewish independence, but they were going to wait for it. That was Gamaliel's approach. Gamaliel used the regular reasoning of Pharisees to convince them of, don't do anything to these guys because our approach is wait. God is going to do what God is going to do. The Messiah they were hoping was coming, but let's wait and be calm about this. The zealots were exactly the opposite. They believed that the Messiah was coming, but they believed that they needed to act in faith. They needed to prove that they were following God and to step out, even though they were outnumbered 1,000 to 1 by Roman army, by the soldiers, even though that they were facing insurmountable odds. They were the radicals. They were the crazy ones. They were the ones completely off the deep end who looked for fights, who tried to fight against the Roman government in every possible way because they were trying to trust that God would deliver them, trying to trust that God was going to save his people. You can kind of think of the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and in our religious terms, the Sadducees may be a little bit democratic, the Democratic Party, a little bit progressive, a little bit, you know, moving ahead with social reforms. And the Sadducees, they embraced the Roman occupation. They at least tried to get along with it. They tried to do what they could with it. The Pharisees, maybe a little bit more traditional, the Republican side, not quite so apt to change things in the social differences coming along, resisting that a little bit more. So the Pharisees rejected the Roman occupation, but they were just going to sit by and watch. The Essenes, hopefully I don't offend anybody, but those are those, you know, libertarians or Green Party, you know, the ones kind of not really prominent, not really politically significant, as near like the Republicans or Democrats, but still had a voice, still like to stir things up, still like to be heard, even if nobody was listening. And then you had the Zealots. And the Zealots are completely not on that spectrum at all. The Zealots were terrorists. The Zealots were those who openly reacted against the government. The Zealots were those, even Josephus talks about, for a period of that time frame that he writes about, that the Zealots had a reign of terror in Jerusalem. That kind of terminology is fairly familiar to us, a reign of terror. That it was their goal trying to disrupt things, their goal trying to tear society apart, to make people afraid. And they were radicals about it. Now, in our minds, terrorists are those that attack Christianity or attack the Jewish nation. But we can think of maybe a few terrorist groups that are closer to home, like Timothy McVeigh. He was a terrorist, and he opposed this government which he thought was oppressive and out of line and completely not what it should be, and so he wanted to fight against it. And many others and many other groups, not quite as famous as him, but groups like, you know, the Aryan Nation, those that have these radical views that, you know, we consider to be, you know, unchristian and just, you know, we don't accept at all. And they're willing to do whatever it takes to put forth their ideas. They're willing to be those radicals. They're trying specifically to stir things up. That was the Zealots. And that was a group that this Simon, I think, had a part in, or at least had some attachment to. He was associated with this group of what we would call terrorists. And yet Jesus chose them. Jesus said, come and follow me. Well, I talked about Judas of Galilee. He's the one that kind of started with. He got killed, but the Zealots kind of hung on after him. They weren't his followers anymore. His followers were died with him, but they were still looking for the Messiah, and they were going to make life hard on the Roman Empire with all that they could. Some called them a band of robbers or bandits, raiders. They would go into a town that was apparently too nice to the Romans, getting along with the Romans too well, and they would steal all their stuff and kill the people in. They would raid a town or a village. They were extremists, fanatical. Some of them even went by the name of the Sicarii, which is a word for knife. And they would walk in the crowds on feast days and assassinate whoever they thought was a Roman sympathizer. And so they were extremists. Now, I don't know what Simon the Zealot did or did not do, or what he personally thought or did not think, but he aligned himself with these kind of people. He aligned himself with this movement, with these ideologies, and yet Jesus chose him anyway. The Zealots, they started back there with Judas in Galilee about the time of Jesus' birth. And a few times we see them active, you know, throughout Jesus' life. And then after, obviously, Simon the Zealot, they're active. But it really comes to a head in 70 AD, 40 years after Jesus, whenever Jerusalem tries to gain its independence. The Zealots say, we're fighting back. They drive the Romans out. It's largely the Zealots who are behind it. They drive the Roman armies out. Well, Rome doesn't take kindly to that, so they come and bring bigger armies to come and destroy Jerusalem. And it's the Zealots who are holed up inside. And they're killing their own countrymen. If their own countrymen start saying, you know, looking out on the sea of Roman armies, besieging Jerusalem, saying, well, maybe we should talk peace. Maybe we should, you know, have some kind of peace talks here to settle this thing diplomatically, because it's not looking too well for us. There's hundreds of thousands of Roman soldiers completely encircled us. We're in trouble. Well, if you talk like that, the Zealots would kill you. And not only did they do that, but shows just how fanatical and extreme they were. Whenever they were besieged and people were maybe thinking, okay, maybe surrender, maybe we try to work this out diplomatically, they burned their own supplies of food in Jerusalem so that people would have to fight, so that they couldn't wait it out. They burned their own supplies of food, saying, okay, we're going to go fight. And Jerusalem was destroyed. So many of them died. A group of Zealots made it up to a place called Masada, which is an old fortress up high on a cliff in Israel. And they held out for a few more years there until they eventually built up a siege work ramp in order to get to them. And finally, Rome wiped them out. But the Zealots, they were the crazy ones. They were the fanatical ones. And yet, again, Jesus chose this Simon, who we know nothing else about, other than the fact he aligned himself with them. Jesus chose him anyway. And then he chooses Matthew, the tax collector. If you could think of two guys that would want to not get along, it would be those two. Simon the Zealot, no, opposed everything Roman, opposed everything government as it was established in those days. Even willing, maybe, or having companions who would be willing to kill them, whether justly or unjustly, to kill them because that's what it took. So tax collectors were the kinds of guys that Zealots pursued, that Zealots put on their hit lists, that Zealots made a hard time for, because tax collectors were Roman sympathizers. They worked with the Roman government, and not just worked with the Roman government, they took advantage of the occupation. They saw this Roman occupation as being a get-rich-quick scheme. Well, who wants to collect taxes? I'll do it. You're taking money from your fellow Jews, giving it to a corrupt government, and skimming all you want off the top in the meantime. Now, Matthew would have been Simon's mortal enemy. And yet, Jesus brings them both together to be his apostles. Jesus calls them both and recognizes them both as his followers. All we know about Matthew in chapter 9, verse 9 of Matthew, he gets up from his tax booth and walks away. And he follows Christ. We're not told anything specifically about Simon, but for Simon to have followed Christ in everything, he had to leave his zealot past behind as well. Some things would have sounded natural to Simon. Whenever Jesus said, take up your cross and follow me, Simon would have understood that, because many of those zealots died on crosses. They often had the term of being a robber, just like that band of robbers I talked about before. And many people think that the two criminals hanging on each side of Jesus weren't just petty thieves. They were revolutionaries. They were those who openly opposed the Roman government. And maybe were zealots themselves. We don't know. But Simon would have understood, take up your cross and follow me, because so many zealots had died on a cross. But just like any fanatical terrorist, thought that it was worthwhile. Thought that they were dying in service to God. Thought that they were dying for a good cause. And so whenever Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me, I would imagine Simon would have said, come on, let's go. Because that's what he knew. That's what was familiar with him. But whenever Jesus talked of peace, whenever Jesus talked of loving your enemies, that would have been a hard pill for him to swallow. But he sticks it out. He's there in Acts chapter 1. After the resurrection, he's still the disciple, he's still a follower, still an apostle of Christ. So he did leave at least a good chunk of that life behind, as did Matthew, leaving behind his greed, leaving behind his desire to take advantage of the poor and of a bad situation, rather willing to serve. Not to be served, but to serve. And so they both took some rearranging of their ideals. But that's what Jesus did. He took them and he changed them. He led them along. He guided them from where they were to where he needed them to be, so that they could be the representatives of his kingdom and carry out his message. Peter, Andrew, James, and John left their boats and their fishing nets. I kind of think maybe Matthew and Simon the Zealot left even more. That they didn't just leave their livelihood, they left some ideals behind. They left some passions, but just like Paul on the road to Damascus. He had to completely question everything he'd ever done before. Well, I can't help but think Simon the Zealot would have been forced to do that as well. And Matthew, at ease and comfortable and, you know, saying, well, this is working out pretty nicely for me. I get to take advantage of this, all this Roman government stuff. And yet he left it all behind to follow what Rome considered was a revolutionary, making himself an enemy of the Roman Empire rather than someone who gains benefit from it. They had to give up a great deal. And so they had to show something. To do the job that Jesus was asking them to do, I think Simon and Matthew are good examples of the fact that it took commitment. And that it's going to take commitment from us. Commitment to not just leave possessions behind, but ideals behind. Be willing to change our hearts and our attitudes and say, I'm giving that up and I'm following Christ and I'm wanting to proclaim his kingdom, not my own. Because that's the danger. Go out and we proclaim, you know, the church as we would want it, not necessarily the church as Christ died for it. But that's what Matthew and Simon eventually did as the apostles of Christ. And why have that commitment? Well, that's where Thomas comes in, why I've chosen him to go along with them. Because they believed. Because they were thoroughly convinced that Jesus was worth it, that he was who he said he was. The Gospel of John is the only one that tells us anything specifically about Thomas. Again, John chapter 11, 16. Thomas says, let's go with him so that we can die with him, showing his devotion and his commitment. John chapter 14, verse 15. He asked the question, Lord, where are you going? How can we get there if we don't know the way? And Jesus responds with, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Thomas, I'm all you need. You don't need to have all the answers. You just need to trust in me. But then in John chapter 20, verse 24, Thomas speaks the most blasphemous thing spoken in the New Testament. Or at least one of them. Jesus is pretty blasphemous himself whenever he says, I and the Father are one. That's why they pick up rocks and try to stone him. Whenever he says, I am, before Abraham was, I am, that's pretty blasphemous. They tried to pick up rocks and stone him. So Jesus could be pretty blasphemous, but whenever Thomas looked at Jesus and said, my Lord and my God, if there had been any non-believing Jews around, they would have killed him on the spot. Why did he say that? Because he believed. He believed that's exactly who Jesus was. Not just the Son of God. Matthew gets credit for, Peter gets credit for that. Peter's the first one who says, you are the Christ, the Son of God. But Thomas, who we call Doubting Thomas, I would say, this is Believing Thomas. He says, my Lord and my God. Full commitment, full trust, full belief. That's what it took them to do their job. They had a big job ahead of them. They had the whole world out ahead to carry the message of Christ. In order to do it, they had to believe it as deeply, as far down deep as you can. That's what we need as well. We can't spread a message we only half-heartedly believe. We can't just spread a message that's just an easy convenience for us. For us to have the job of spreading the message of the apostles, we have to believe with that belief that convicted Simon the Zealot, that convicted Matthew, and that convicted Thomas to do what needed to be done to be the messengers and the servants of their Lord and of their King. So my question this morning is, do you believe it, really believe it, that He is your Lord and your God? And if you do, then no matter where you come from, no matter how bad your history might be, it doesn't matter. Simon the Zealot was a terrorist, for all we know. But he believed, and so he changed. And that's what God asks of you as well. So if you need to come to Christ this morning, if you need to express your belief, to say, I do believe, to confess it on your mouth that you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and then be washed in baptism for the forgiveness of your sins. That's why we offer the invitation, to make it clear that we would love for you to do that. And if you need anything, we can help you with it all this morning. Won't you come as we stand and sing?